the 31st study of the Book of the Apocalypse, held at the Enfield Collegiate Hall on the 2nd of November 1976. Brother John Knowles, the class leader, speaking to the subject, The Persecution of the Witnesses and the Consummation of God's Judgment upon Catholic Rome, and the reading, Revelation chapter 11, verses 11 through to 19.
Our brother John is going to lead us in the study, again from Revelation, the title of The Persecution of the Witnesses and the Commendation of God's Judgments, Consummation of God's Judgments upon the Catholic Rome. And to introduce that subject, we're going to ask our brother Gary Lepordovan to read to us from Revelation chapter 11, verses 11 to the end of the chapter. Gary, and now we'll pass the meeting over to our brother John, and the subject again, the persecution of the witnesses and the consummation of God's judgment on Catholic Rome.
We plan this evening, class members, to finish off Revelation chapter 11, which we commenced at our last class, and I plan just for 1 or 2 minutes to briefly review the matter we did at our last class, because as I said last time, Revelation chapter 11 possibly is one of the trickiest in the book. I know that's not a good psychological start, but really if you can master Revelation chapter 11, you won't have any trouble with any of the other chapters that follow it. And the only reason it may seem a little difficult is I think the majority of us aren't terribly familiar with the historical events around about this particular period of history. I know, speaking for myself, coming up through Sunday school on that, I knew a bit about ancient history. You know, you knew a bit about the Greeks and the Romans and the Babylonians and the Persians and that, and a little bit about 20th century history. But there was that whole slab around about the period of the Arabs and the Saracens and the Turks that we did in chapter 8 and 9, and also this period around about the 17th century and the 18th century, where they deal with all the Louis and the Napoleons and the French revolutions and the wars and those sorts of things. In fact, I must be honest, it wasn't that many years ago that if you said to me who came first, Louis the 16th or Napoleon Bonaparte, I would have said, well, look, I've no earthly idea. Now, if you then say, well, I don't know either, don't be worried, because what I intend to do tonight is to deal with a fair amount of history. I think it's important, but I'm going to deal with it really simply, because frankly I can't go much further than that. I've only got a fairly simple knowledge of this part of history, so let's all be at the same level. Well, for those perhaps who weren't here last time, I think one of the best ways of summarising the main theme of that early part of chapter 11 is to look at the three time periods that were mentioned there. Now, as we glance at those three time periods, let me just restate that in these early verses, we are introduced to two witnesses. Our first reaction is that these people must be witnessing for the truth. And we found that that is not necessarily the case, and in fact it isn't the case in the majority of instances. So, just remember this point. Every time you come to Revelation 11, it's not so much that they were witnessing for truth, but they were witnessing against the apostasy. They were witnessing against the Catholic Church. Rub out the first part of that sentence. Many of them were apostate. They were witnessing against the Catholic Church. And of course, in the midst of the group who were witnessing against the Catholic Church, there were the Protestants, who, whilst they witnessed against Rome, they of course believed error themselves. Say they were one of the two witnesses. And the other of the two witnesses would have been the political activists, those who just didn't want Rome to rule over them, but it wasn't that they were particularly religious. So the two witnesses consisted of religious witnessing against Rome and political witnessing against Rome. Of course, we must allow for the fact that in that group who were the religious Protestants, there was just a small group. There were just a small group who, of course, did believe the truth. So the main thing we notice then is that the story of chapter 11 speaks of the great persecutions that the Catholic Church brought against the people who are under it. And in particular, of course, there were the saints who were going to suffer, and they are styled the Holy City there in verse 2. The Holy City, that very small remnant of people who were the believers. Now, there were three time periods in this chapter. Two of them were actually the same period of time, or shall I say, the same length of time, but it was at two different periods. They were both a period of 1260 days. Now, in chapter 11 and verse 2, we are told that for 1260 days, but it's there described as 42 months, 42 months is 1260 days, there would be a period of treading down. And so the witnesses were, or the holy city was to be trodden down from AD 610 through to 1870. Now look, for the moment, even if you've forgotten what 610 had to do with and what 1870 had to do with, at least we can see the period that we're spanning. It's somewhere about 600 years after the time of Christ, and it brings it down almost to our own day, at least up to 100 years ago. So it's that period of history, which I submit, the majority of people don't know much about what happened during that time. Why don't they know much? Well, frankly, it was a period when the Catholic Church was so supreme that they did suppress all form of knowledge. You know, writing and great historical works and that sort of thing were not flourishing because the Catholics suppressed everything. So whilst you can go back, you know, even into the BC period and find monumental classical works and things like that, during this period from 600 to 1870, the Catholics had everything under their power. So there was a period of 1260 years of downtrend. Now in verse 3 there is a similar period of time, but it slightly overlaps the other one, and this was the period during which there would be a group of people witnessing against the Catholics. And that's the time period in verse 3, which goes from AD 312 to 1572. So whilst I said it wasn't important to know what these periods are, it won't hurt, of course, for us to repeat them. AD 610 was when Photius gave certain power to the Pope. And the Pope had this power, known as his temporal power, the power to rule as a ruler, not just as a religious man. But he had power over land, he had power over people. He controlled the papal states in Italy. From 610 through to 1870, which was the time when the Pope lost his temporal power. Now this other period here starts from the very time of Constantine. You know, that first of the three earthquakes in the book of Revelation. When pagan Rome became Catholic Rome, well, for that very moment, there were people who were witnessing against it. And that witnessing continued right through to 1572, to the period of time known as the Massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day, when their witnessing came temporarily to an end. Now the next time period we came to was the period mentioned here, and I haven't noted the verse, it's verse, it occurs again in verse 11, but the first occurrence is verse 9. In verse 9 you've got the 3.5 days, and by what you might have thought was rather obscure sort of reasoning, but it does come from Eureka, the 3.5 days can be made to equal 105 years. And the reasoning is this, that they are lunar days, there being 30 days in a lunar month, and if you take 30 times 3.5, it gives you 105, and it is that period from 1685 through to 1790, when there was a period of further persecution. You say, what happened between 1572 and 1685? Well, the witnessing came to an end in 1572, but then after a while there was an edict which came out which said, let's tolerate these people. It was known as the Edict of Toleration or the Edict of Nantes. And then in 1685 that was taken away again. So there was another terrible period of persecution from 1685 to 1790. Alright, so what was it all about? Periods of persecution. One ending in 1870 when the Pope lost his temporal power. But the one that we're going to be looking at particularly this evening and the remainder of this chapter is this one now that brings us to the epoch 1790. So, if Constantine, this fellow back here, who changed paganism to Christianity, if he was in God's sight the first great earthquake in the world, the first great political upheaval from the time of Christ down to today, then this 1790 or thereabout period is the second great earthquake. And that's the period of the French Revolution leading on to the period of Napoleon. So in answer to that question I mentioned earlier that I didn't once upon a time know the answer to, the French Revolution came before Napoleon, but not by much. One sort of merged into the other. So this evening we're going to have a look at the French Revolution. You may not think that sounds very exciting. I think if we can see it in terms of the scripture, it is very exciting, because Revelation speaks about three earthquakes. The first one's Constantine, the second one's the French Revolution, and the third one's the return of Christ. So in God's viewpoint, this is a very, very significant event. If Constantine threw paganism out and brought Catholic Rome to the fore, what did the French Revolution do? Well, the French Revolution got rid of Catholic Rome. Catholic, again I repeat, in the sense of universal. The word Catholic means universal. Rome lost its universal power, and it became simply thereafter a religious system with a lot less power. And for the sake of the records, we're calling it Papal Rome. So the terminologies we're using are Pagan Rome, Catholic Rome, Papal Rome. So we got the story, up to 312 then it was Pagan Rome. From 312 through to the French Revolution it was Catholic Rome, when Rome held sway over a large part of the world. And from the French Revolution down to today, all that's left of Rome is a religious power, which is styled Papal Rome. So what happens then when we start up in verse 11 of this chapter? We read that after 3 days and a half, the Spirit of life from God entered into them, and they stood upon their feet, and great fear fell upon them which saw them, and they heard a great voice from heaven saying unto them, Come up hither. And they ascended up to heaven in a cloud, and their enemies beheld them. Let's go to our notes, which we shall follow fairly closely from time to time. And we notice that verse 11 bridges the material which I've just said with what we're going to say hereafter. So let's just read that note. Page 124, about a quarter of the way down. Having found fulfillment on the slaying and lying dead of the witnesses, in the persecution of Protestantism in France, following the revocation of the Edict of Nantes, and the close of their dead period in the national justice of the French Revolution in 1790, Brother Thomas dwells at length in Eureka upon the revival which has since taken place, not only in political liberty, but in the resuscitation of a witnessing for gospel truth in which he himself had so important a part. Among the circumstances of which he makes mention as belonging to this period of revival is the establishment of the British and Foreign Bible Society in 1804, that's just straight after the French Revolution, by which, in defiance of the mandates of the God of the earth, the scriptures have been circulated greatly among those nations in which the witnesses stood upon their feet again, greatly strengthening the earth in its resistance to arbitrary power, and preparing the minds of many to receive and seek for the truth as it is in Jesus. Other attempts to return to primitive Christianity are noted on the part of the Sandemanians in 1755, the followers of Walter Scott and Alexander Campbell in the United States. Brother Thomas was himself associated for some time with the latter, and it paved the way for the much greater advance which he started in 1834-47. The resurrection of the witnesses, together with their display of power, filled the authorities with fear and forced them to proclaim the convocation of the Estates General in 1789. This in turn precipitated the terrors of the French Revolution, 1789-1795. Now, don't worry if you only understood about one line of that. Reading that through quickly, I appreciate it could be difficult, but by the time you go tonight, you'll understand every word of it, I'm sure. One thing, though, that I think is very interesting when we look at this, doesn't it put Brother Thomas in rather an interesting light? You know, we just see him as a man, we say, well, certainly he started the Christadelphian movement. But, you know, when you see it like this, he is, in effect, mentioned here in Revelation 11. There's no doubt about that. You know, with the resurrection of the witnesses, along comes the French Revolution. And if it hadn't been for the French Revolution, and for those changes which took place, then how could you have had the Christadelphian movement? So God looked down upon this. He used men like Alexander Campbell and Walter Scott. They performed a work. But the one that he was waiting for was Dr. John Thomas. And so Brother Thomas, I think it was 1805, the year he was born in, the year when Napoleon is really marching through Europe and making his presence felt, the year when Napoleon dealt the Pope a very deadly wound in a spiritual sense. And so in that year, Brother Thomas is born. By the time he reaches maturity, there is a reformation taking place in America, and there is the right man in the right place at the right time to perform the work of Revelation 11. So you need have no fear in saying that Revelation 11 speaks about Brother Thomas and the Christadelphian movement. And that really starts to make it meaningful. It's all right to talk about the Edict of Nantes and all of these other things, but, you know, we are part of this system. And if we can see ourselves as part of history, then I think it makes history just that much more meaningful. So we're looking then at some significant events which were taking place around about the end of the 1700s. This period, 1790 through to the 1800s. Now, none of us were alive at that time, so we don't know from experience what actually took place. So we're going to then try and create a picture of the situation as it was at that particular time. Now, you all know Europe. You know where Europe is. It's up in the northern hemisphere. We're going to start right from first principles. We all know where Europe is. That is a part of Europe known as France. All right? I think at times we can assume that we know a lot more than what we do. I thought I knew where Germany was until I went there a few months ago, and I found that I didn't really know much about it at all. So I'm not going to assume you even know where France is. This is the English Channel around here somewhere, and that's France. But more particularly, that's France in 1789. And what you've got there, even though you might not be able to pick up all of the different words, is the way in which France was divided up in 1789, showing provinces and principal centres of administration. One of these centres of administration was known as the Parliaments. Here it is, P-A-R-L-E-M-E-N-T-S. Spelled slightly differently from our English word, but the same idea. And in these places which have a round circle with a dot in it, were these parliaments. There were 13 of them, and France was divided up into these 13 parliaments. That's just interesting, by the way. What we are concerned with, though, was the form of government which existed in France at this particular time. Now, we've got a heading here, French Society in 1789. You remember we showed some slides shortly after getting back in July or August, whenever it was, a few months ago. You remember some of those slides of Joe's which showed the palace in Ludwigsburg? You remember we said that this was what it was like before the revolution? Well, if you can just call to mind the opulence of that particular palace in Ludwigsburg, which was in effect an echo of other palaces like the one in Versailles and other similar palaces throughout Europe. This was when Europe was ruled over by monarchs who ruled by what they called divine right. Incidentally, I don't mind if you write these things down, W-R-I-T-E, while I'm talking. So the divine right of kings was the situation before the revolution. Now, if you can get that picture, you've got a fairly clear idea of what was going on. Now, French society then, leading up to the period of 1790, was a society which was ruled over by various kings. There was Louis XIV. Louis XIV gave his name to certain types of furniture and all sorts of things like that. It was the day when the kings, they just lavished money on themselves, while the peasantry, they were living in just a poverty-stricken situation. So when we get to the end of the 1700s, we come to this one known as Louis XVI, XVI-16. And Louis XVI ruled as one of these absolute monarchs. He was an absolute monarch. You know, what he said went. In Louis XVI's case, it was a little bit different because he was a rather weak individual. But anyway, as king, he was absolute monarch. Now, there was a particular situation theoretically existing in France which no one had ever allowed to be put into practice for well over 100 years. This was known as the Estates General, sometimes called the States General. It was the only national assembly that France had known in the 17th century, and it had not met since 1614. So from 1614 through to 1790, there had never been a meeting of the representatives of the people. That's nearly 200 years. The king made the laws, and the people, the majority of the people, had absolutely no say in their destiny whatsoever. So this was what was known as an absolute monarch, the divine right of kings. Louis inherited the problems which had been caused by the extravagance of his predecessors, particularly Louis XIV, Madame Pompadour, names like this which come to mind around about that particular period. And his need to borrow money soon reached a condition of bankruptcy. He was not ruthless enough to make absolute monarchy work, and yet he wasn't strong enough to force reforms. And so here now was the time which God had ordained right from the time he gave the apocalypse to John, and doubtless before in his foreknowledge, that there was going to be a change. If the truth was going to start to thrive, then you had to get rid of this system. And so here then was a system that had to go. The divine right of kings had to go, because as we're going to see in a moment, the Catholic Church was part and parcel of this whole system of things. Now, we spoke a bit about this, the Estates General. This Estates General had not been called together since 1614, but the Estates General consisted of three different sections: the First Estate, the Second Estate, and the Third Estate. Now, whilst these three estates had never been called together, the First Estate and the Second Estate did have considerable power. The reason why they never called the Estates General together was because the Third Estate was the majority of the people, and they didn't want them to come in and put something to the vote because it would have gone out. So let's have a look now at these three estates. The First Estate, and you'll find Brother Thomas refers to this quite a bit in Eureka, you'll find it all in there. The First Estate was the clergy, particularly the upper class of the clergy. So the First Estate was the clergy. The upper clergy were hated by the people. They lived in luxury at the expense of the peasants, who were forced to pay a church tax, a tithe, while they were exempt from all taxation. So here were these upper class clergymen, and they were known as the First Estate. They had tremendous power. And if we think that the Roman Catholic Church wields power today, it wields nothing by comparison with what it had then. So that was one of the estates. The First Estate was the clergy. The Second Estate was the nobility. These were the nobles. Their wealth was based on land ownership, and they also exploited the peasantry. They were exempt from taxation. They monopolized positions of privilege, and they could get enemies imprisoned without a trial. It was just a matter of signing a document, and they could get anybody put into prison they wanted to. No trial whatsoever. And they were the people that ran the country. As a matter of fact, at the time of Louis XVI, he was so weak that these two groups here, the First and the Second Estates, were getting a lot of their own way. But they, as the world says, pushed their luck a little bit too far at this particular time. And so the time was now ripe when things were going to change. In order that the witnesses might be resurrected and that the truth might be brought to the fore, all of this had to go. Whilst there was a king ruling as an absolute monarch, and whilst he pandered to the wishes of a small minority, the clergy on the one hand and the nobility on the other hand, people like you and me, who would have been the rest, had no hope of getting anywhere in life, either in a material sense, or for that matter, really in a spiritual sense. I can't say to what extent the average person would have had access to a Bible, but we know this much, that they didn't get much time, let alone opportunity, to do things like Bible study. In a moment we'll have a look at the third estate, and we'll see that the peasants would have paid up to 70% of their income in taxation to these parasites, because that's all they were, the first and the second estates, people who were living off of others. So this was the situation in France. There was a king ruling by divine right. There was a theoretical national assembly comprising first estate, second estate and third estate, but it had never met since 1614. I presume you still want that up for a little bit longer, do you? Right, what can I talk about while you're still copying that down? I don't want to get onto the third estate. Well, we can read the note on the bottom of page 124. Those who still want to copy that, you copy that and you can read this note later. On the bottom of page 124, we've got this comment on verse 12. And they heard a great voice from heaven saying to them, "Ascend hither." And they ascended into the heaven in the cloud, and their enemies beheld them. So here's a group now that are going to be resurrected and ascend into the heavens. Not the literal heavens, but you see it is based upon the symbol of the Lord Jesus Christ, who was in the grave for 3.5 days and eventually ascended to heaven. But these are going to be the ruling heavens. So here is a group then that are going to come and ascend into the heavens, and their enemies are going to behold them. Once again, our notes tell us the symbology is based upon the literal death, burial and resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ. But as with the rest of the symbols in this chapter, this ascension relates not to the literal heaven, but to the political heavens. The royal decree of Louis XVI convoking or calling together the Estates General permitted the oppressed classes to send their representatives to Parliament. As a result, the Roman Catholics viewed the situation with much fear. So what happened was that there was a rising middle class, the traders, the merchantmen. They didn't come under the first estate and the second estate, but they were starting to gain a certain amount of power, and they pressed for the calling together of the Estates General. I think at this stage we better go on to the third estate, and maybe if you didn't get all that down, leave yourself a little bit of room and we'll put it up again at the end of the class and you can copy it down at that stage. We come now to the third estate. The third estate was made up of really two groups. There was, well, we can call them all the commonalty. But they were made up of two groups. There was firstly that group called the bourgeoisie. It's a word which often comes up today. The communists talk about the bourgeois society and all that sort of thing, but it is essentially a French word. It's the bourgeoisie, and the comic goes on to tell us what they were. They opposed the rule of privilege. They wanted abolition of tax barriers and other hindrances to trade, and they resented having to pay heavy taxes. These were the merchants, what we would call today the middle class people. These were the shopkeepers, these were the tradesmen. These were the people who were making a reasonably successful fist of life, but they were limited. They had no say in society and they had to pay a lot of money up. These were part of the third estate. And the other part, which of course was the bulk of the people, were the peasants. They bore an enormous tax load, and yet they were the poorest class. They paid a tax on salt, of all things. Salt tax they had to pay. They paid income tax. They were forced to work on public works and pay taxes to feudal lords. Some peasants paid up to 70% of their income in taxes of various forms. So society was full of injustice and class hatred was severe. This was the situation which had built up over hundreds of years until we got to this particular period. So there we have now a monarch ruling by divine right, but a weak, vacillating man. The nobility and the clergy wielding great power, but now a rising middle class who saw the time opportune to make a change. The rest of our transparency here sets out a series of propositions as to the causes of the French Revolution. Many of our young ones here may still be at school and may be doing modern history. This is a typical sort of question which comes up in exams and in essays you have to write. What were the causes of the French Revolution? And it's a bit like the scribe saying to the Lord, you know, which is the greatest commandment? If you say it's commandment number one, well, they say it's number five. And so when someone says to you, what was the cause of the French Revolution? Well, whatever one you say, someone can come up with a different one. Because there were just so many things which seemed to cause it. But they were all there at one and the same time. So I've listed off there nine things which are generally recognised to be the causes of this great revolution, which is referred to here in verses 11, 12 and 13 of Revelation chapter 11. The first one was financial chaos. We've already mentioned this, a bankrupt administration. So that was part of the situation which precipitated this revolution. The second one was the nobility. They were determined to keep their privileges. This word privilege was a very important word. We even have it today, don't we? We talk about parliamentary privilege. I'm not quite sure what it means, but it means that if you're a politician, you can get away with something that you couldn't get away with if you weren't a politician. These nobility had the same sort of privilege, and the particular privilege was this letter, which they could write and say, put him in prison, and no one could do anything about it. And they wanted to hang on to that. And so whilst they saw this rising middle class, they sort of closed their eyes to it and said, no, we want to hang on to our power. A foolish thing to do. On top of that, they had some bad harvests. And if you're pretty poor to start with, and then you can't get any food as well, that doesn't make you too happy, and you're prepared to do just about anything to save your life. So you can see the peasants now were ready for revolt. Not only did they look at a king who was bankrupt and see the nobility who were treading them down, but they were going hungry as well. So all of these pressures were building up a situation where it was ready to erupt. There was, of course, the absolute monarchy, which we refer to. And because this king was absolute, he was at a distance from his people. He had no idea of gauging the public opinion. And one could imagine that when you see these palaces they lived in, the peasants would never get within sight of these people. And the king would have no idea how a peasant had to live. The fifth one, which we've listed here, which is a very important one, is the bourgeoisie. These are the wealthy merchants who were determined that they wanted to get political representation. We're making the money for the country and we've got no say in what's happening. The sixth one, and this is rather an interesting one, the sixth one was the American War of Independence, which had only just taken place a little while earlier. And there was a lot of connection between the War of Independence in America and what was going to soon erupt in France. This is explained better by, in fact, the next point which is coming up. Against the American War of Independence, we've noted there that its policy was that all men are equal before God. All men are created equal. Now, where did they get this idea from? They got this idea from a group of men who had developed around about the 1730, 1740, 1750 period, who were known as the philosophes, from which we get our philosophers. So there were these French, predominantly French philosophers in this middle 1700 period who started sitting down and doing a lot of thinking. And this period of time, therefore, was known as the period of enlightenment. And these philosophers started writing on topics like the rights of man. One chap by the name of Locke wrote quite a bit on this subject. And if ever you read the American Declaration of Independence, you'll find whole slabs taken out of Locke's writings. They speak about the inalienable rights of man in terms like this. It's rather interesting too, the declaration of that was read by David Ben-Gurion in 1948. It's got a lot of very similar slabs in it too. It's rather interesting reading it not so long ago to see how closely it bears on the American Declaration of Independence. So you see, America was getting away from, was it King George, I think, George III, or one of those Georges in England. They were getting rid of an absolute monarch. So the French look over at America and they say, hey, it worked in America. I reckon it can work here. So the American War of Independence was a success. It was based upon the theories of these philosophers. And so these philosophers released new ideas into society. So this period of enlightenment was teaching people that, you know, who said he's there by divine right? All men are created equal. God didn't make that king any different from you. You're all human beings. We've all got equal rights. Therefore, we should all have equal rights before law. We're all created equal in the sight of God. That's fair enough. Why should he have all that money? Well, I mean, we've heard all this story, haven't we? Since 1790, that's been the cry of everybody. I want more. He's got more than me. Therefore, I want his. And, of course, it's coming up to the fore very much in our own particular age. So there was this philosophy of Locke and Rousseau and others of these philosophers. There was point number eight, the clergy, who were corrupt and they were hated by the people. And finally, there was the king himself. I've made a separate title for the king as distinct from what I've styled absolute monarchy up here. Whilst absolute monarchy is the system, the man himself, I mean, if it had been, say, Louis XIV, the revolution mightn't have happened. But because it was Louis XVI, who was a weak, vacillating man, and who was badly advised, all of these things impinging together caused the revolution to take place. And so in 1789 then, with all of these particular situations there, and with the time period about to be fulfilled, there was going to be an earthquake which was to be felt right throughout the world and would affect the whole structure of society. So I think it is important that we have some idea of some of these things in order that we might get the picture of the tremendous change that took place here when there were slain of men 7,000 and the remnant were affrighted. Whilst you're perhaps still copying the rest of those notes down, I'll read from page 125, which is a comment on verse 13. In that hour there was a great earthquake, and the tenth of the city fell, and there were destroyed in the earthquake 7,000 names of men, and the rest were terrified and gave glory to the deity of the heaven. An earthquake, in symbolical language, is a shaking of the earth, which in the political system of the world is representative of the common people. In this instance, it is graphically descriptive of the events of the French Revolution with its upsetting of the old kingdoms of France, which was one of the 10 kingdoms of Europe, or styled here a tenth of the great city, and of the substitution of democratic rule in its place. The National Assembly proved far too powerful for the king and the court, and consequently the king was reduced to its mere executive officer. The National Assembly was replaced in 1791 by a newly elected Legislative Assembly, the aim of whose members was not merely to limit the monarchy, but to abolish it altogether. The king was practically a prisoner in their hands, vainly hoping that foreign invasion by other monarchical powers already commenced would affect the restoration of his position. But on June the 29th, 1792, an armed mob invaded his palace and demanded that he should sanction the decrees of the Legislative Assembly for expelling from France all priests who would not swear allegiance to them, and also a vigorous prosecution of war against those foreign powers by whose interposition he was hoping for deliverance. What had happened was, the king was bullied into calling the Estates General together. So they got these three estates together and they said, okay, we'll vote on the basis of estates. So the first estate and the second estate said, we'll vote together to maintain our privileges, So the third estate can't win. But the third estate says, no, we are by far the largest in numbers. We want to have voting on the basis of single votes. And they said, you can't have it. It will be voting on the basis of estates. So we'll win 2-1. So they said, no, we won't have it that way. So they marched outside, and the third estate constituted themselves an assembly, the legislative assembly. They said, right, we're going to govern. We'll do it. And so that's what they did. And that's really what started the revolution. There was probably, you know, humanly speaking, many reasons why the revolution could have been averted, even at this stage. But it wasn't. And the king made some silly decisions, and the nobility wouldn't bow to the wishes of the majority, and so it was on. After some weeks of tension, 48 sections of the city of Paris petitioned the assembly to decree the dethronement of the king. The palace was subsequently besieged, the royal family imprisoned, and later beheaded. In your notes, you probably see a picture there of the storming of the Bastille, as it is represented in some of the earlier drawings. You may be interested in one or two other pictures here. Don't know how that projects up, but that was Louis XVI. That was the man. He was the king at that time. You don't have to copy that one down, so you can get that one fairly quickly. This was probably his arch enemy, who mentioned quite a bit in Eureka. This is a chap by the name of Robespierre, and Robespierre was quite a brutal man when the time came on and the period of the Reign of Terror came in the 1790s. Robespierre was instrumental in organising the assassination of quite a number of people. The storming of the Bastille, when you've got a picture like this in your notes, that was traditionally the start of the revolution. Although I believe when they stormed the Bastille they only found 7 prisoners inside of it, the Bastille to them was the symbol of the divine right of kings, of old France, as it was. And for those who have a desire for the gory, there is the head being held out there of that other fellow you saw a few moments ago. That's the sketch of the execution of Louis XVI, which we referred to in our notes as the guillotine. In case you've got a weak stomach, you won't leave it up there for too long. But that was the situation as it was in the time. It was a pretty gruesome situation when the revolution broke. And so, finishing off our note here, we read that 40 days after this, the National Convention was constituted, and by a unanimous vote, the President declared that royalty was abolished in France, and on September the 22nd, 1792, the new Republican era began, 1260 years after Justinian's delivery of the saints into the hands of the Pope. And incidentally, that's another 1260 that we didn't mention last time. 1260, 3.5 days of years, is a very, very important time in the Bible. So if you go back to Justinian, what was it, 532, I think, when Justinian gave certain power to the popes, well, 1260 years from there brings you to 1792, when the monarch was beheaded and when a republic was declared in France. The 7,000 names of men, which are referred to in this passage, indicate men of dignity, and 7,000 is a symbolical number signifying completeness. In the revolution, all the monastic and sacerdotal, together with all the ranks and degrees of nobility, were utterly abolished, no title being recognised higher than citizen. The property of the privileged orders of the old feudal society was confiscated, the churches were despoiled and dedicated to the worship of the goddess of reason. This was the new religion of the philosophers. They were really worshipping their own intelligence. Man is the measure of all things, and statements like this, which they were resurrecting from the old Greek philosophers and others. The rest were terrified, finds its counterpart in that phase of the revolution known forever in history as the Reign of Terror. The victims of the massacres in Paris and in other parts of France are reckoned at over 1 million. When the passion for vengeance and blood had spent itself, constructive work began, and in its earlier stages, at the instigation of Robespierre, the National Convention decreed acknowledgement of the existence of the Supreme Being. Not that, of course, they worship the true God at all. Right, one further transparency then I think we have on this subject, which I think is important to bring this down to some meaningful terms as far as we are concerned today. What were the results of the revolution? What changes did this revolution bring about in society? Well, here are some of the results of the revolution. What actually eventually brought the revolution to an end, and please, you write while I'm just talking on there. What eventually brought the revolution to an end was the fact that whilst this revolution was going on in France, other countries surrounding France, Germany and Austria and those places, still had their monarch there, their absolute monarch. And so they were massing on the borders of France saying, well, look, we'll come in and help the king. And that's what he was hoping they would do. So France then had to be united together against these enemies outside. And so, to cut a long story short, they eventually raised over themselves a general by the name of Napoleon Bonaparte. And so it was Napoleon Bonaparte that massed the armies.